This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nolan Giles. On today's show, we pay tribute to waterways and rivers and consider how they continue to shape our built environment. The artist Leo Villarreal shares the latest on the Illuminated River project, which spans across 9 bridges in London. We then head to New York to find out how the practice of daylighting has unearthed the city's Sawmill River. And finally, we end up in Denmark, where one project hopes to bring residents a little bit closer to the riverside. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. We start today's show in London on the banks of the River Thames. Here to complete the Illuminated River project this spring, 5 bridges are to be lit, including Waterloo, Westminster and Blackfriars. The public art installation transforms the city's iconic bridges with a soft, undulating lighting scheme. Monocle's Maile Evans spoke with Chris Waite and Alex Lifschutz from the architecture firm behind the project, Lifschutz Davidson Sandlands. But to start, let's hear from Leo Villarreal, the artist behind the luminous design.
We approached each bridge, first of all, studying what's there already. So looking at the illuminations. And in other cases, we looked at the Olympics, for instance, or some special event where there was some kind of illumination or some attempt at it that was temporary, and studying that. And some other historic things that had, you know, on Westminster, there was illumination underneath the bridge that wasn't there anymore, or these medallions that go across, you know, the expanse, which had lights behind them and that ceased to work at some point. So taking those cues from the historic, and in the cases when we've been able to speak to the architects of the bridges, it's been amazing. And, you know, fortunately, we have Alex talk to about the Golden Jubilee footbridges and ways of illuminating those. And we also had a collaboration with Fosters and Partners on Millennium and understanding what the intention was with the lighting, which is so important. Sir Norman Foster wanted to create this effect of this blade of light going across the Thames inspired by Flash Gordon, which I love this kind of pop cultural reference. And but in the end, the illumination of the bridge really kind of was lacking. And so we were able to speak with Andy Bowe and the, you know, many of the original project architects about what those intentions were and kind of fix it and make it right. So it was a very long process, but I think it's been exciting to take a look at the bridges and to do something that is thoughtful and well-engineered and energy efficient and reduces light pollution and does all these things that, you know, illumination should do, in the hope that it will stand the test of time and be up. And it's very extremely well engineered, and I'm so grateful to our partners for all of that. It's something very exciting, and we're really thrilled to share it with everyone in London.
And what Leo was touching on there is the fact that both Chris and Alex have a long-standing existing knowledge of the River Thames. So maybe we'll start with you, Alex, and move on to you, Chris. But you've worked in the South Bank area for many years, so how did this knowledge come to the fore on this particular project?
As Leo said, we collaborated on the lighting of Golden Jubilee bridges, which we designed, which were completed in 2002. But we've been working on the river and continue to work on the river for a long period. There's a tremendous culture around the river in London, and people who have fed into it and who thrive on it, whether it's the bridges, whether it's the foreshore, the history of the river. And, you know, because we're Londoners and we've worked on the river, we've imbibe some of that, and we continue to work on the river. And so it sort of comes naturally. It's a bit like it's in plain sight. Where Leo has an advantage over us is that, I mean, he knows London well, but he can see everything fresh. We see things only when sometimes when they point it out to us, because they're in plain sight, because we know them so well.
The bridges, I mean, we thought we knew them well at the start of the process. Again, this idea of twig gathering information was all important, but I think where we got real insight was talking to people who knew the bridges better than anybody, which was the engineers who worked on them. You know, they would be able to tell us things we would never have found out ourselves. For example, on Westminster, with the artwork, we need certain places around the bridge or on the bridge to put certain pieces of kit that allow the artwork to illuminate. And one of those is, you know, a series of PCs and various other components. And we were talking with the engineers on Westminster, scratching our heads as to where we were going to put all this kit. And then one of the chaps said, well, there's a room underneath this statue here. So he took us round down the statue of Boudicca, adjacent to the bridge, and he sort of pulled out this pack of keys, 400 keys on this, you know, 10 minutes going through the keys, found the one that worked, opened this door. I mean, the stench was something... something special, but as soon as he opened this door, there it was, this watertight, weatherproof room that we could use. And we would never have known that without speaking to these people. So it was really interesting for us, as people who know the area, to actually really get to know the bridges intimately with these people that helped us along the way.
I mean, Leo, this isn't a piece of artwork that's constantly changing. Could you tell me a little bit more about the sequencing involved? I understand it's generative, so it doesn't go through a set repeating pattern.
Well, we've been developing our own custom software for over 20 years, and it's really exciting to be able to make these kind of bespoke tools that I can then use to create the sequences. But within that, we've really engaged a lot of chance and randomness in the process, so... the sequences are presented in a random order, and this is the first time that we're really engaging in generative sequences, meaning that previously I would see something and I would record it and we would play back the recording. But in this case, it's actually making it on the fly. So we've really been able to evolve in such a way that I feel comfortable with the generative, and it's kind of a very new direction for me and for us in the studio. But opens up all kinds of possibilities. And I guess the ultimate goal is for people to be able to look at the artwork again and again and see new things in it. Because it's abstract and non-repeating, it's very open-ended and people can make of it what they want. It's not just the artwork itself. It's all about the, you know, the Thames. Is the tide high or low? Or is it smooth? Is it reflecting? Is it foggy? Is the moon out? All these environmental factors play into it as well. But those things have actually inspired the sequencing, and I've learned things night after night being with the bridges and observing the rain and the fog, and that actually changed some of the patterning that I created. So it's intended to be a mirror of the kinetic activity around it and the color, the palette, all these things. It's really a kind of a meditation on London and its bridges and all the things that are going on. But everything is so lively around the bridges, and why shouldn't the bridges actually have some sense of movement and time?
And over to you, Alex. This work isn't in a gallery setting. It, as Leo mentioned, there are cycles of the day and night. There's an ever-shifting backdrop, and there are lots of environmental factors at play. I wonder, from your side, what were some of the ecological factors you had to keep in mind, and maybe some of the considerations when it comes to sustainability for a project of this scale?
We were all very concerned to make sure that we had a lighter carbon footprint than any artwork could reasonably expect, and also than any lighting scheme that had previously been on the bridges. So we call it sort of hairdryer amounts of electricity per bridge, you know, between 5 and 15, something of that order of kilowatts per hour. Because Leo's sequences aren't necessarily bright all the time, and they fluctuate. The amount of energy is actually very modest. I mean, it is domestic, to be clear, in comparison to what was there before, and that's partly because of, as I say, his undulating and fluctuating sequences, but also because of the LED, the very, very efficient LEDs that we use. So that's the starting point, and then directing the light so it doesn't hit the water in a way that creates a barrier for fish moving up and down, doesn't irradiate the riverbanks with light so that the creatures that are spawning there become food for predators. Working with the London Wildlife Trust to really understand the ecology, bat and bird surveys and so on. For Leo's art to work, it wouldn't be right if it had to be the brightest thing in the world in order to be seen. And we felt very strongly from the beginning, we pitched with Leo at the competition for the idea that we would, at the same time as creating this wonderful artwork, also think about ways in which we could soften the surroundings. Cities are navigated by people looking for landmarks. That is traditionally how you look for a church spire, you look for a railway station. But the way in which cities have developed and light has developed is that everything is lit, and everything is lit as brightly as possible. So that's very much a thing that we have become concerned with, which is to try and modulate, to say what we call save the night, to actually create a situation where his artwork and the night and the ecology can flourish, because actually the night is dark. We don't want it to be a version of the day with lights on.
And Leo, you've done other bridge projects such as the San Francisco Bay Bridge. I mean, this Illuminated River project is of a different scale, I suppose, but what have you learned from engaging with this river in such an intimate way?
Well, it's been such a pleasure to think about this project from the very beginning, from when we were doing the competition. I arrived in London late at night from New York and dropped my things off, and I immediately went down to the river and I started walking and walking and walking and realizing that there was so much of it. You could really walk along the banks and experience the bridges from so many different points of view. And I was very interested in how people were using the riverbank. And so that observation was very interesting and quite different than the Baylights, which is, you know, it's 1.8 miles long and 525 feet tall. So it's enormous, completely different scale. So there was an intimacy to the Thames and so much beauty. And I thought, you know, these bridges are so magnificent, but they just disappear into the inky darkness. And what could we do to kind of make them visible again? It's not about just putting a ton of lights on it. That's not the point at all. It's something about doing the least amount possible, but to kind of enhance and to show the beauty that's there, doing something that's very elegant and slow moving as well. As if someone were to kind of look at the illumination, they think, oh, is it even changing or moving? But once you start to kind of look at it for a longer period, you start to see, oh, yes, it is. I'm always inspired by the patterns of the body, like the length of a breath or the heartbeat or these things that we know very well, and bringing some of that tempo into the sequencing. So I hope it will help people kind of slow down and to see in a new way. And it's this journey as you walk along, you see one bridge and then the next and then the next. So it's really this progression, which I think is so beautiful. And I hope that people will take the time to take that walk and to really appreciate this magnificent city that, you know, we get to all, you know, enjoy.
That was Leo of Villarreal there. And before that, Chris Waite and Alex Lifschutz. They were speaking to Monocle's Maylee Evans. To keep up to date with the Illuminated River and news on the bridge's unveiling, visit the website illuminatedriver.london. Now we continue to drift leisurely downstream and ponder how architects and landscape architects alike have fostered a closer relationship with their respected riversides. To discuss successful examples from across the globe, this show's researcher Nick Manise spoke to Monocle's editor-in-chief and host of The Urbanist, Andrew Tuck. To begin, the pair spoke about some potential projects that have been floated for the River Thames.
We've seen proposals in recent years of tidal pools being installed in the Thames, hopefully once the super sewer is complete and you're not competing with raw sewage. Is this something that you would like to see more of, rather than just focusing on the actual banks of the river, but moving into actually more closely engaging with the river, whether that's a pool that might invite us to swim in it, or even steps that run down onto the river becoming more accessible? Because I do know there's a few little stairwells where you can get on at low tide, but would you like to see a better river interface and actually getting in there?
Well, it's not Sydney Harbour, let's be clear about that. You know, the banks of the river are muddy. Famously, Bazalgette put the embankment up to stop London being flooded because there didn't used to be sufficient walls to stop the water, the tidal waters, and when the river flooded, coming into the city. But when you go down onto the riverbanks, which people used to do all the time because there were boats and things there, on that foreshore, you still see all the detritus from hundreds of years ago, loads of old pipes and bits of brick from years ago. So it's not a beach in the centre of the city. And the idea of tidal pools there, I think it's unlikely. I think you would have to have some incredibly cleansing system in place. But how do you then make a connection with the river that is a little bit more daunting, threatening, a little bit dangerous, to be honest, if you could just fall in it? How do you make a better connection? And I think there are ways of doing some things, but again, it's quite tidal, so you can't just build a platform because suddenly it'll be submerged. So I think for most people, it's having some kind of floating structure on it that would work, whether you have some giant pontoon system or whether you have the use of effectively what's boats moored alongside so you can get out onto the water. But it's not exactly in the most swimmable places. So I think for now, it's more making a reconnection, even from path to water. That's the most important part, because we've felt pushed back from the riverbanks. And London is a city that was built here, that's only here because of the Thames. And for many years after the industrial period, we lost touch with the river. And even just the use of the river for, you know, boats and all those things and river taxis, there is some of it. But even that is still underplayed in an extraordinary way.
It sounds like it's less about a novel intervention, but more about actually tapping into the things that we already know work well on rivers and doing them better. Another thing you sort of touched on there, you mentioned sort of industry along the river. And maybe London does have it perhaps better than other cities, which are more cut off from their rivers by huge swathes of industrial land, but also highways and roads that run along them. At the same time, we have this sort of yearning to be connected with the river and want to break through those barriers. We've seen numerous projects over the years, from Paris Plage, where they shut off essentially a stretch of road to cars and let people spill over there in the summer, to the likes of New York's Brooklyn Bridge Park. I'm putting you on the spot here. Do you have a favourite that you might have seen over the years where land that was previously not open to the public has been turned back over to them so that they can better engage with the river?
The Paris setup is interesting. There, which has happened a bit in London, is actually where they have these pools that you can swim in, these submerged pools. It's because they're actually putting them more in docks than actually in the middle of the Seine. But the Seine isn't quite as wide as the Thames, and the use of the embankments has been easier to do there. But, you know, Paris, again, it is impressive that they made this reconnection with the Seine, which had disappeared. But they have the same problem as London. You still have these highways that run effectively alongside much of the rivers, and these do disconnect you a little bit from what's going on there. Other cities, well, you know, we have an HQ in Zurich. There is a lake, of course, but there is a river in Zurich as well, several rivers. And when you go to Zurich, the use there of the rivers in summer is extraordinary because it's less tidal, of course, so it's just a fast-flowing, very clean water. There are bars and there's a kind of an understanding about the people who use the space. I find it really interesting. You can pick up a jam jar to put your cigarettes in and stub it out and then you take it back. You know, of course, in London, people would be damn off throwing them in the river after a few beers. That just doesn't happen. There's a social contract with people that they really look after this space. And it's beautiful. You can dive in the water there and you're propelled along by this fast-moving water. And a lot of people go. If you go there, you know, if you sneak off of a lunchtime on a Friday, it's packed with people who have taken the afternoon off to use the water. And many cities, they've just done well for a long time at keeping connected with water. And I would say that all those Swiss cities, there are cities where you can jump in the water and be with your bag, a special bag with your work clothes in, be propelled along the river, get out, dry off and go to work. People literally do that, and we've shot it for the magazine. So if you've got alpine fresh water, it makes a slight difference to Thames mud.
Zurich's probably actually a good place to wrap up this conversation because they also have a program where they deliberately daylight stream. So in the 20th century, a lot of rivers and streams were turned into either concrete encased water bodies or completely submerged in pipes underground. And Seoul's Chongguichen stream is perhaps the most famous example of that, where it was previously in pipes under a major road in the city, and it's been opened up and completely transformed part of Seoul into this vibrant pedestrian space, but also a space where wildlife has come back and there's fish in the stream again, birds are returning. How important is bringing the wild back to the banks of our rivers and to our rivers themselves? Why is this so critical for landscape architects particularly to work on and reintroduce into the city?
Well, you just look at the year we've gone through. We know that people feel better mentally when they can see greenery, when they can see flowing water, that physically they feel better if there's a place where they can run or cycle or go to stretch their legs during the day. And many of these natural assets of our cities were taken away from us. So, as you said, many of them were concreted over, whether that's in Los Angeles or in South Korea, in Seoul. And here you see big programs around the world, people saying, how do we take this back? And the other thing is that with the climate change issues that we're facing, when you have heavy downpours and flash floods, concreted over land just becomes a water plane, and suddenly you have terrible flooding. So we know that buildings are adding special basements to take in rainwater and things. But if you have some land where the water can run away to, if you have a stream, then suddenly these problems begin to go away. So it's important for big scale things like that, for management of sustainability and for making cities which can look after themselves, but it's also good for our mental and physical health.
Thanks to Andrew Tark, host of Monocle 24's The Urbanist and Monocle's editor-in-chief. He was speaking to our Nick Manise. In that discussion, the pair mentioned the practice of daylighting, which is uncovering bodies of water that previously were hidden. Now we visit one example of this in New York. With a report from Yonkers, here's Monocle's Clarissa Sebag Montefiore.
For nearly a century, the Sawmill River has been buried under the streets of downtown Yonkers, a commuter city a 30-minute drive from Manhattan. I am standing opposite the railway station, where a car park once covered the river. Today it flows unhindered, thanks to a $19 million public works program by the city of Yonkers, in collaboration with landscape architects and engineers. Known as daylighting, it is part of a larger worldwide trend to peel back urban development covering rivers and to let their waters flow freely once again. Here in Yonkers, there are benches for families to enjoy the view, plaques that explain the local ecology, and meandering walkways. Plus, a number of animals have made the river their home.
And we have a freshwater pool here. And normally in a spring day or a summer day, you'd find mallard ducks, and egrets, and turtles. We have various fish species, including American eel and carp, largemouth bass, and sunfish. And we're hoping at some point that we'll get alaweaves back in here, which is like a Hudson River herring, which have made a comeback in some of the tributaries, and they're hoping to find them here.
That's Bill Schneider, a senior director at PS&S Engineers, who worked on the daylighting project.
Just up a little bit farther, you'll find there's a fish ladder, which is installed to allow the American eel to access the river. Eels are born out in the Sargasso Sea in the Atlantic, and then they come back and migrate and live in the fresh waters. And we're hoping that they'll flourish here.
Bill grew up in Yonkers, raised his family here, and still lives here today.
I find our office being right above the daylighting here. I get to, fortunately, get to look out at it all the time, and I find people out there congregating, having lunch, just enjoying the outdoors. And we've recently gotten a significant amount of residential here in the downtown area. These buildings are brand new, developed by ORXR Development. And it gives people a place to recreate, and they don't have to drive. They just walk right out and sit in the park. Plenty of dog walkers and nature lovers and artists. It just improves the overall quality of life. And personally, if you can hear the sound of running water, it's very comforting.
The area we are standing in was daylighted back in 2012. Now in fourth and final phase is in its planning stages, with the goal to daylight the river at Chicken Island, a parking lot for retail spaces that has been developed into a residential center.
The city of Yonkers owned and operated it as a parking lot. It was recently bought by a developer, so soon Chicken Island will likely be transformed into something totally new, which is very exciting. That provides a great outlet for the people that are going to hopefully live there in the future, because residential is planned for there. And they'll be able to walk right out of their door into a daylighting river. It'll be like a park forever. We're hoping that it will, similar to the phase one down here, that it will breathe life into that area that has for years been the object of development, but no one's ever got it going. No one's ever been able to really make it happen, till now.
Key is getting the local community involved. One way is through the Great Sawmill River Cleanup Day.
It starts early in the morning, and they'll have different groups which will be all along the river throughout its length, and they'll take a particular area and then just get right into the woods and the reeds and the rocks and clean up all the trash that they find. In that way, it encourages stewardship of the river. There's people of all ages, old and young, high schoolers to senior citizens. I myself am there every year when they have it.
For Bill, daylighting the river, combined with community efforts to keep it clean, marks a new environmentally conscious age, one which he welcomes.
I think as a society we're becoming more and more environmentally conscious, more concerned about our sustainability. What better way than to expose something that was buried for years to park cars on, and then to expose it to show what should be here and what was here hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years before us.
For Monocle, in Yonkers, New York, I'm Clarissa Seabag Montefiore.
My thanks to Clarissa Seabag Montefiore for that report. And finally on today's show, we have one more river-related story for you in Denmark. Here we head to the city of Randers and the Gode Nord, Denmark's longest river that stretches across the Jutland Peninsula. There, Monocle's Gabriele Della Sante visits a development project underway that hopes to bring residents closer to the water.
Entering the city of Randers by train, you will cross vast wetlands as the Gode Nord River forms a delta before flowing into the Baltic Sea a few kilometers away. The river equally splits the city into a north and south part, which have distinct characteristics. The north is home to the old medieval center, while the south has a more industrial feel and is dotted with shopping centers and factories. Danish architectural firm C.F. Møller is in the early stages of a large-scale project here. They want to bring the city back onto the river, what is now a rather desolate and unused area of the city. A mere crossing point between north and south will become the heart of the community, filled with housing projects, cafes, sports centers, and parks. I meet the lead architect overseeing the River City Randers project in C.F. Møller's luminous offices in Aarhus. His name is Lasse Palm, and he's a Randers native.
Randers was born along the most narrow site of the river delta of Gode Nord, which is one of the most beautiful river deltas in Denmark. Actually, Randers is the one and only river city in Denmark. Well, the city has for many years turned its back to its initial place of birth, which is the river. So it's a classical story about a city having, over the 50s and 60s, introduced industrial areas along the harbor side, blocking the connection between the city center, which is a beautiful medieval city center, and the beautiful nature river delta of the Gode Nord.
Lasse and I hop on a train and head over to Randers. Here he shows me the extent to which the project will transform the city's urban landscape.
Where are we? We are just on top of the heart and the backbone, which is the river of Gode Nord. And we are looking over the huge nature delta just outside Randers. The water flowing through the city. And here, standing on a bridge, a central piece connecting north and south. This is really, really, really beautiful nature areas.
Lasse shows me the areas, or blue urban spaces, that his team have designed. These are areas around the water where citizens can spend time and where investors can envision new residential projects as the city grows. These blue urban spaces are also protected by a long river wall that acts as a barrier and prevents future flooding from damaging the newly developed areas. To put things into context, Denmark is a flat country increasingly threatened by the prospect of rising sea levels, and a city like Randers is no exception. For Lasse, this project was all about embracing the threats of climate change as an opportunity to strengthen the city.
The project is basically about how to embrace those threats in a positive way. How do you embrace that you will get rising stormwater issues without blocking the way or the accessibility from city and citizens onto the water? We deliberately tried to create as many different experiences, meetings between water, nature, and city life. So, for instance, we have housing areas, which is placed on top of a dike that protects the city. But just in front of that dike, we've created a new delta area, adding new housing qualities and new ways of living with the nature delta, actually. So that's one part of actually living with the water and the threat.
Whether adjusting to a future climate or wanting to bring citizens closer to the water to enjoy nature, Lesse is certain that the Ranas River City project will provide inspiration for other cities by the water, both at home and abroad.
It definitely sets a standard. It's a well-known aspect in Danish urban development at the moment, how to handle these big-scale issues on climate adaption. So we try in Denmark to investigate how we can use that challenge as a benefit for many cities rather than just making them a problem, because they have this scale and magnitude that we turn it into a potential rather than a challenge.
For Monocle in Rannes, I'm Gabriele De Lisante.
My thanks to Gabriele De Lisante there. And that's all the time we have on today's show. For more design stories, please catch our 5-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. It airs every Thursday. And if that's not enough river-related radio, our friends over at The Urbanist have a Tall Stories episode this week on Beirut's riverless forest. It's well worth a listen. Today's show was produced and edited by Maylie Evans, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. Thanks to our researchers Nick Manise and Charlie Fulmer-Court. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.